celebrating the music and movies of John Hughes.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
I was very proud to be in that film because obviously his reputation as being the guy who captured a certain culture of American youth was really up there. For an English band to sort of be part of that scene as well, that seemed to be the way John Hughes was, wasn't it? Because I mean, he obviously used Simple Minds as well on other films, and English bands were represented quite a lot in his movies.
I know that there's art cinema and I know that there's commercial, but I felt like there in the 80s that commercial and the arty were merged a bit more.
Welcome to Life Moves Pretty Fast, the podcast that celebrates the movies and the music of the late, great filmmaker John Hughes. My name's Hadley Freeman, a journalist and a John Hughes superfan, and my co-host is the brilliant music supremo Tarquin Gotch, who worked with Hughes on many of his films. So Tarquin, which of John Hughes's films are we going to be talking about today?
We're going with the first film he directed, 16 Candles. This film is about a teenager's worst day. A poor, beautiful 16-year-old girl and her worst day at school.
So like all John Hughes teen films, it can kind of be summed up in one line. Perfect for a movie poster. You can see John Hughes's roots in advertising there. A teenager's worst day. That's it. And then he thinks, all right, what would a teenager's worst day consist of? It would be, oh my God, the family forgets that it's her 16th birthday. Terrible. She's embarrassed at school in front of her crush. A nerd is leching all over her, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And within that, he just packs in as many human stories as possible.
1984, it came out, and it sort of reset teen movies. It was greenlit by Ned Tannen, a very successful executive who previously had greenlit Animal House in 1978, which did $141 million. And then that was followed by other teen films like Porky's in 1981, which did $111 million. So Hollywood had woken up to the teen movie, but this was a very different kettle of fish. This was not sort of exploiting young female flesh or coarseness. This was a big jump into how teenagers felt.
Now, you say that, Tarquin. I'm going to slightly disagree with you here because 16 Candles is one of the few John Hughes movies that I don't entirely love. And it's interesting that Ned Tannen had worked on Porky's and Animal House. I like Animal House. I revere John Belushi. I do not love Porky's. And you can see the influence, really, of those movies, of the sort of the crudeness of both those films in 16 Candles. And I think that's why 16 Candles has endured the worst of all of John Hughes's teen films. You know, there are many things in it that will look extremely, almost incomprehensibly dated to today's teenagers.
Yeah.
There is the one scene in the shower with Haviland Morris, I think her name is, who plays Carolyn. Although it's interesting that in that scene, which is very Porky's, you know, people are watching her in the school shower. Although it is interesting, it is different. It's girls watching her rather than boys.
Yeah.
Envying her body rather than lusting after it. But when you watch 16 Candles, are there any particular moments that stand out for you as something that just feels like, oh my God, this feels so dated now?
Well, there's the unfortunate storyline where Jake Ryan says to the geek at the end of the movie, as he sort of palms his attractive girlfriend off with the geek and his Rolls Royce, he says, she's so blitzed, she won't know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference being between the geek and her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which sort of, it's not awful, but it's not great.
It's not that great, is it?
It's not, no, but you know, at the beginning, I talked about the films that had sort of led to this teen revival of the teen movie. It was the 1980s. There's a film with John Cryer in it, No Small Affair, where John Cryer's a younger man and he stalks Demi Moore.
Right.
And nobody had a problem with that. The wonderful Kelly LeBrock was in The Woman in Red. The poster is of her wearing a red dress in the sort of Marilyn Monroe style of the air, blowing the dress up. And you've got Gene Hackman's
Gene
head. Gene Wilder's head down here. I mean, you know, Molly Ringwald was complaining about Judd Nelson looking up her legs. Well, there was a poster with it. Even perhaps more troublesome, Blame It on Rio, a Michael Caine film,
yep,
in which two dads go to Rio and fall for each other's daughters. I mean, so against that backdrop, I would like to plead with the court that really John's missteps, if that's what you want to call them on this film, really are not really that serious.
You know, I agree. And I think it's a bad tendency today to hold art from the past to modern standards. I think that is silly and narcissistic.
Society's values have changed so much in the last few years, as we all are aware.
Paul Hirsch, legendary film editor of Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Planes, Trains and Automobiles.
That John's humor is set in the 80s and doesn't always play particularly well today. You know, the homophobia in some of his gags, you know. A friend of mine teaches an editing course, and he showed the first motel scene where they wake up, you know, with that that country song, In My Baby's Arms.
It's not a pillow.
And the class didn't find it funny. They just, that's not funny.
Hmm.
You know, they just, times change, mores change, attitudes change.
There are elements to that which feel almost like the pre-Hughesian era.
Bill Brown, head of post-production and second unit director on most of John's films.
They feel like studio notes that he took in a way. And I'm not trying to blame a faceless studio for that. He was so firmly rooted in the world that he lived in.
Correct.
You know, and I think that it was really reflecting that and also reflecting a time in the early 80s. Like you were alluding to, he wasn't a person that felt misogynistic or racist.
Not at all.
There are things in that that I think in today's context are somewhat disturbing, but I don't think they are an indication of the man's character. And I think they are a slightly out of context now that we're looking at them 40 years down the road.
I know people have spoken in the past, including some Asian American actors, about how much they hate the Long Duk Dong character in this film, played by Gere Watanabe. Well, they call him a Chinese exchange student. It's really not entirely clear where in Asia he's from. And it is kind of every terrible cliche of an Asian teenager being sex mad and loves, you know, white women. You know, this is, I think, almost the same year, perhaps, as Karate Kid with Mr. Miyagi. There were a lot of bad Asian stereotypes around at the time. And as you say, you know, the 80s movies weren't very great on race. You know, you have something like Soul Man, this insane 80s movie starring C. Thomas Howell about a white teenager who wants to get a scholarship to Harvard, so takes a lot of tanning pills to get an African-American scholarship and blacks up for the whole of the film. So without a doubt, race was treated in a bad way in 80s movies, and sex was also treated in a very strange way in 80s movies. The scene at the end of the film where the nerd, played by Anthony Michael Hall, wakes up with Carolyn, the hot prom queen, played by Haviland Morris, and she tells him how much she loved having sex with him drunk, is very Revenge of the Nerds, very Porky's, those kinds of movies at the time. The thing that I find quite weird about 16 Candles is that the character of Jake, who's presented as this idealized hunk, is so unpleasant. Like, why would John Hughes want his lovely leading lady, Molly Ringwald, who he already had a friendship with, to be palmed off on this awful guy who brags about how his girlfriend is so drunk he could, quote unquote, violate her 10 ways and she wouldn't know it? I mean, in any decade, that sounds pretty horrible. So it's never quite clear to me if John Hughes wants us to like Jake, because I think actually while he was making the film, maybe even while he was writing the film, he realized that actually he preferred the dork character played by Anthony Michael Hall. And that is kind of the more appealing male character in the film. And we see him wrestling with this dynamic again in Pretty in Pink, when Molly Ringwald again plays a girl who's torn between a dorky character now played by John Cryer and the beautiful hunk played by Andrew McCarthy. And it's a problem he has repeatedly in his films, that the girl should and has to end up with the beautiful hunk, but the dork is often more fun.
There's two things to talk about there. One is the third wheel, which is a recurrent theme of John's.
Right.
I'll come to some of the themes that John established in this film. But he obviously wanted the girls to end up with the geeks.
Right.
I think he, on this film, he realised that his heart lay with the geek.
Right.
That's what he wrote Pretty in Pink as, that Molly ended up with Ducky.
Right.
Unfortunately, there was no chemistry there. There was no sexual tension between Molly and John Cusack.
John Cryer.
John Cryer. Thank God you're here, Adley. Thank God. And then he went back to it in Some Kind of Wonderful.
Yes.
And made sure that the male lead there was worthy.
Yes. Well, I mean, the thing with Some Kind of Wonderful is in order for the main character to end up with the dork, he had to make the main character a man and the dork to be a girl, because you can have a beautiful dorky girl. You can't have a good looking dorky guy. That's not how it works in the high school universe. So that
how
was kind of, that's kind of the problem in this one, where Anthony Michael Hall isn't as, you know, classically handsome as Michael Scherfling, who plays Jake. It was a problem getting Pretty in Pink, in which John Cryer isn't as classically handsome as Andrew McCarthy. Now, we'll talk about Pretty in Pink another time, but I would just like to say that, in fact, the most beautiful man in that movie is James Spader. But that's a different issue. We can save that for another week.
Well, we could argue for Charlie Sheen in Ferris Bueller.
I mean, 100%. Genie should have gotten together with the druggy Charlie Sheen, so...
Class differences. Another common thread through John's movies is class differences and how that impacts on teenagers and stops them, you know, that's the obstacle in the road to love throughout his films.
Yeah, it's interesting in this film that Jake is so rich, and it's very pointed that he's so rich. His parents have all these Rolls Royces, which Jake doesn't worry about trashing. The house is absolutely massive. I think any English person looking at the Molly Ringwald family house will think that's pretty big. But in the John Hughes universe, that's just a kind of another suburban house. Whereas Jake is seen as the rich, handsome, idealized jock. And I think in John Hughes' early ideas about teens, that's who all the girls would want, would be the rich, handsome jock guy. But like you say, as he was making this movie, I think that he did realize that he had the most fun with not just the geeks, but also Molly Ringwald's younger brother, who gets most of the funniest lines in the film. Like that little kid, you kind of want to see a movie about him, to be honest. I want Mike's movie.
As you go through his films, by the time you get to Ferris is rich.
Yeah.
Lives in a lovely house. But the best friend is even richer.
Yeah, that's right. Cameron. That's
in
right.
Some Kind of Wonderful, the hunk has no money. He's a struggling artist. Right. So, you know, John started to play with it and moved it around.
Yeah. But in our next episode, we have a movie that really points to class differences. Pretty in Pink is almost, that's almost the main theme in Pretty in Pink, in which Molly Ringwald's character lives on literally the wrong side of the railway tracks. How was it for John Hughes when he was working on this film? Because it was his first directing job.
Well, it was his first directing. He'd come off a lot of success as a writer the previous year with Mr. Mum and Vacation. He'd been at number one in the box office for 11 weeks in a straight row.
Wow.
And Hollywood sort of woke up to this prodigious talent lurking in Chicago. And this was John's first film as a director. He was slated to direct Breakfast Club first for A&M Films, and that had a budget of about $1 million. And then Universal stepped in and offered him this film with a budget of $6.5 million.
Wow.
So you can see that, you know, if you were John Hughes, you'd go, yeah, and you would jump on this. But one perhaps can say that, you know, he jumped into it. He didn't have all the time to prep it in the way that he did Breakfast Club.
Right.
So perhaps some of these faults that you're endlessly finding with it, Hadley, can be forgiven for that reason.
Yeah.
It was 16 Candles. At the beginning of 16 Candles, he was just given a PA on the film's budget. He had no staff. He was just a man at home. And it was as they realised how successful he was going to be that they started upping his budget and upping his staff. And here we have Jane, his lifelong PA, talking about it.
So I was interviewed during post-production of 16 Candles. I was living in LA, and it was me and one other girl, and John was talking, and this other girl kept talking along with him. And I was just enamored listening to his stories. You know how when he starts, he goes laughing, and this girl kept chit-chatting in and joining, you know. After about, I'd say, an hour maybe, he looked at the other girl, and he was like, well, thanks for coming by, and, you know, walked around or whatever. And then he came back, and he looked at me. He's like, you want the job? And I'm like, yeah. Yes, and I'm thinking to myself, geez, I'm not saying anything. I'm just here listening to him, which he loves, you know, of course.
Is consistent in all the interviews that we've done for the podcast that John loved to talk.
Oh, God, yes.
And somebody said to me, why do you think he didn't really love directing? And I said, because directing is so demanding, you can't talk. He couldn't sit on the set and spend 2 hours chatting to anybody.
I think he didn't like the production, you know, shooting. It was too social of a thing. There were just too many people coming at him.
Bill Brown.
And I remember, I can't remember what film it was, but I remember he had one of those counters in his hand, you know, like the turnstile people have to click, 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 click. I was like, what are you doing? And he clicked it when I said, what are you doing? And he said, every time someone asks me a question, I click it, you know, and he was up to hundreds and hundreds of questions. There's an aspect of this that I don't think he liked, but being in a cutting room with a few people that he was really comfortable with and taking that final pass of the film and getting it just right. And he was really good at it.
You were in charge of the script cupboard, the sort of secret vault of untold riches.
There was a giant walk-in closet that we had put shelves in. And literally, I kid you not, that thing was filled, floor to ceiling, every shelf, just scripts, scripts. Some were, you know, 10 pages, some were 200. I mean, just, and even when I first started working for him, right after I was hired, I ended up getting the chicken pox from one of the kids. And he sent me Pretty in Pink, Some Kind of Wonderful, which had a blue cover. God, I wonder where those original covers are. Pretty in Pink was red with pink letters. And I guess the other one was, I want to say Breakfast Club. But yeah, he would send me those and just be like, take a read. Let me know what you think. And but back then he would do the covers, the, you know, the nice covers, laminated colors to match the script.
You had to eat the script cupboard in alphabetical order. You had to keep putting the records away.
Oh, my God, yes. I'd bring Ron in after a while for that because that became massive, like a day job for sure.
Of course, John had a massive record collection that I was extremely envious of.
Ron Payne.
He and Nancy would take whoever was working with him at the time. We'd go out to dinner. And then if we went to Spago, you know, just across the street was the Tower Records on Sunset. And so we'd walk in there and he would walk out with literally, you know, armfuls of records, or maybe Jane or I would help carry them. I thought, oh, one day I'm going to be able to afford just to walk into Tower and buy whatever I want. He had a massive record collection and he would play music as he wrote. Of course, John wrote overnight. So he'd start at 9-10 o'clock at night and then write till 4 or 5 in the morning. So he would play records and John was not diligent about putting records back in the sleeves. So it would just be 12 inches, 45s, EPs, just laying on couches and chairs and floors and leaned up against the wall and just like a bomb had gone off in there. So yeah, so I'd come in the next day. I'm coming in at 10 a.m. He's asleep. I'm in his office, home office, putting all the records back in their sleeves. Take me a few hours. You know, that afternoon, he'd start writing again and blow it all up again. I think one thing that John and I had in common was we were both Midwesterners. He grew up in Michigan and Illinois, and I grew up in Indiana. So I think I connected with John as just being a Midwestern guy. But then, yes, we, you know, I was a huge music fan, and John obviously is a huge music fan. So I think we connected as just music lovers.
I would stay up all night when he wrote, the wee hours, the sun would come up, he'd go up to bed, I'd leave, I'd go home, shower, go back. And we work, you know, mostly out of his house. And then I'd do the office stuff or the house stuff or honestly, whatever came up. The kids needed to be driven to soccer practice, or I used to meet with his accountants, schedule his meetings, attend all of them. I used to attend all his meetings with him in the beginning.
If he was writing, you could not disturb him. And so while he was a director and a chief executive of a small company, effectively, he would disappear for days if he was in the flow and you just couldn't get him. I remember how, you know, we'd be desperate for an answer, you know, on one of the films trying to replace something. And is this okay, John? Is this okay? no answer for days and the clock's ticking and you're like, ah.
He would never start writing usually till after dinner, unless he was on an absolute one of those pushing through on a roll. Nothing was stopping him. Lived on coffee and cigarettes, as we know, unfortunately. 3 packs a day easily of his Carlton's. You know, they're so low in nicotine, he'd say. They're the lowest one. I'm like, it doesn't really matter. But, and coffee, like just nonstop coffee. Even after I stopped working for him years later, I never slept at night. My friends would say, like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, yeah, I'm just not trained to do that. I'm trained to be up all night. Just go, go, go.
16 Candles. It went on to make just under 25 million on a budget of 6. So, you know, was profitable. And that kind of set up some of the hallmarks of John's trade.
And it's interesting, you can see in this film that there's really only one character he feels a close affinity with, and that's Sam, played by Molly Ringwald. She's definitely the actor that he enjoys being with the most in the movie. He also wrote this film, we should say. He wrote it and directed it, and he wrote it with Molly Ringwald's photo on his desk. So he knew he wanted her to play Sam. At no point in the film does she lose her dignity, really. I mean, she gives her underwear to the geek, but we don't see that. And she does that because she's making a friendly gesture to him so he can impress his friends. She doesn't lose her dignity. She doesn't behave badly. She is really the John Hughes character in what is otherwise very much a kind of more Porky's traditional 80s teen film.
Were you a film buff yourself at that time? Were you going to the movies a lot, or were you, no, just focused on music?
Oh, no, I was focused on film.
Nick Hayward.
I'd like to have been in film, not as an actor, but in some way writing film or being involved in film that way. I love story. I mean, that's what I love about 16 Candles. It's a story, and I love the way it starts off with that great line about they forgot my effing birthday, and then it ends around a birthday cake, 16 candles, you know, a table shot by the window. It's sort of like rounded off and in only a story, perfect story, goes, which is what's missing. It's like there's a great story there and it's not getting bogged down with the production of the day and all the processing of the day, which I find like music and film are suffering from that at the moment because everybody's got a computer and got the technology. Everything's kind of similar in that way, you know, generic.
One of the things that obviously is very appealing in this film to teenagers is that the movie is on Sam's side and we see how ridiculous her parents are and her grandparents are through her eyes. And I think this film really set up a trope that we see throughout teen movies, John Hughes and non-John Hughes films, which is that it's the role of the teenager to fix the parents. The most obvious example of that is Back to the Future, where Marty McFly goes back in time to fix his parents. Risky Business is slightly too, where the Tom Cruise character fixes his parents' expectations and becomes a better son for them by becoming a pimp. Another example of weird 80s movies. And Endless, in every single teen movie of the 80s, it's all about the teenager fixing their parents. And that is really set up in 16 Candles.
Isn't Back to the Future a bit dodgy as well? What does he do when he goes back in time? Doesn't he date his mum?
Okay, excuse me here. As a Marty McFly-ologist, I can correct you on this one. He doesn't date his mum. He has to take his mum to the prom where she will kiss his father so that he and his 2 siblings can be bored and not fade from the photographs. I know that when Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, who were the director and writer of Back to the Future, were trying to get it made, most studios actually turned down Back to the Future because they found the whole plot of the mother falling in love with her son so nauseating. But I've got 2 sons myself now, and it's not like I'm in love with them, but there is a connection a mother has with a son, and if you don't know it's your son, it's quite sweet how they do that. She has these weird feelings for him that she doesn't understand, and there's the scene in Back to the Future, which I love so much, when Leah Thompson kisses Michael J. Fox and then backs away and says, I don't know what's wrong. It feels like I'm kissing my brother. So I actually think they handle it really well. People always say this about Back to the Future. It's so weird that he makes out with his mom. There are many, many, many weirder sex scenes in 80s movies. I mean, we could talk about Big, for example, where a 13-year-old boy is having sex with a 30-year-old woman for most of that film because he's now in a grown-up's body. I mean, that is pretty freaking weird. So
yep.
I will defend Back to the Future here on our John Hughes podcast. You can also tell that it's John Hughes's first directing movie because he has so much fun with the music. As you've talked in previous episodes, Tarquin, he was a huge music fan, a huge British music fan. And it's funny looking at Sam's bedroom, Sam being Molly Ringwald, Sam's bedroom, in that it's filled with posters of British bands. I think there's The Cure in there, Squeeze, all these random British new wave bands all over her bedroom. And he has a lot of fun with the soundtrack. Now, I hadn't realized till I rewatched the movie for this podcast, Tarquin, that the music supervisor for 16 Candles is someone who I don't revere as much as you, obviously, but another great music legend, Jimmy Iovine.
It's true. He was a big executive at Universal. This was a Universal movie, stroke A&M, had the soundtrack. And I have to say he did a brilliant job, you know.
I feel I should explain who Jimmy Iovine is for the few people out there who might not know. So yeah. There is a Netflix documentary about him called The Defiant Ones, which is a lot of fun. He is someone who's very good at capturing different moods and different feels in a whole wide variety of music. So he's probably best known for his work with Bruce Springsteen. He produced the Born to Run album. He's also very well known for his collaborations with Dr. Dre and has now made, I believe, $1 billion through those Beats by Dre headphones. Have you made $1 billion with headphones, Tarquin, as a fellow John Hughes supervisor?
Sadly not, no.
That's what billionaires do, is make podcasts with me. So I'm surprised that that's not how you went too.
Jimmy paid his dues as an executive at Universal for many years.
Oh, I see.
And was very involved in introducing rap and hip hop to major label success.
Right.
So all credit to him.
So given that he's now associated so closely with hip hop and really helped to bring hip hop into mainstream American music, why is this movie so full of new wave British bands?
John Hughes.
Right.
Quite simply, it's what John liked and was listening to in high school. He was listening to English imports. And so when he made a film about high school, he filled the soundtrack with what he liked. And, thank goodness he did.
The story I heard from 16 Candles.
Ron Payne.
The movie Mixers. We worked with them on another movie later on. And I remember them telling me that John would just disappear for a couple hours from the mixing stage, come back with armloads full of records, and just do what they called needle drops. To get the best sound quality possible, you try to license the master tape, and that gets mixed into the movie. So you have the best possible quality sound. But there was kind of a jokingly derisive term of needle drop, which is you would just get the vinyl album, drop the needle, and play it. And of course, yes, movie people had a kind of a slightly derogatory term in needle drop, but that's a lot of what 16 Candles was. John was picking songs during, the mix of the movie where he just come and bring records to the stage and play records until he found a song he liked.
What we do know is that you and I would then be in an absolute panic trying to get the rights.
Yes.
It's already in the film.
You much more than me.
You mentioned in your sleeve notes that in the prom scene in 16 Candles, 8 songs were played.
Oh, the dance, yeah.
And the specials, of course, ended up on the soundtrack. Can you remember what the other ones were, by any chance?
I think the high school dance sequence started with the Peter Gunn theme by Ray Anthony. Yeah, it's a perfect song to portray teenage geeks, isn't it? In their head, they're a super spy. In reality, they're these spotty, goofy teenagers. So it was, I think it was the Peter Gunn theme, and then it segued into True by Spandau Ballet, which is also on the box set. Then goes back to, the joke cue of the Dragnet theme by Ray Anthony again. Then it goes back to, I think, the Oingo Boingo track, and then it's the Specials, Little Bitch. Then ends with kind of Ira's track, Geek Boogie. So yeah, it's kind of like geek music joke, teen music, geek music joke. Yeah. But Little Bitch, I love the way that's used in the dance sequence at the high school. It's when he finds out that he has to get the girl's underpants, right?
Yes. The music is used superbly throughout. One of my favorite scenes is the prom. There's always a prom in a teen film, and sure enough, there is. And there's a marvelous scene where Spandau Ballet's True plays, where Sam looks across the dance floor at Jake, who's dancing with his pretty girlfriend. And then Jake's eyes lock on. And it's just a fantastic moment. And the music's really kicking. And it was Spandau Ballet's first ever sync. Here's Steve Dagger, their manager.
John's doing post on 16 Candles. He gets to the mixing stage and the score sits there like a, I shouldn't say a wet blanket, but it doesn't excite him. He goes down to Sunset and comes back to the mixing stage with carrier bags full of records, one of which was True. And he just tried these records against Picture, particularly in that scene where Molly Ringwald stares at Jake, the hunk, and the hunk looks back.
Roughly when was that post?
Autumn of 83.
We did a hugely successful in-store at Tower, where there were screaming girls and the place was completely covered in True albums.
So not surprising if that's where he shot. Fantastic. I mean, and this is a very expensive way. You're on this huge sound stage. And I mean, the sound mixers are going insane. And he goes, no, I want that in. Now the film company gets in touch with Chrysalis and needs the rights. Unbeknownst to you, they're in a tight place because it's in the film.
So I got a phone call from somebody called Peter Casely. In those days, there were no sync departments in record companies. It was dealt with by business affairs. He said, we've had a request to feature True in a film in America. I thought, well, that's good. Wow, film in America, fantastic. The only thing is, he said, it's a first-time director. So I could sort of feel my heart sinking. And he said, and they don't have much of a budget. So I said, right. I said, what sort of film is it? And he said, it's a teen film. Because at that point, the teen genre hadn't really been reinvented. I mean, I thought, oh, God, how much? And he said, they've got $5,000 aside. And I thought, God, you know what, though? Somebody wants to put us in a film in America. It's the first one. Sold the money, let's do it. 1983 was the year that the True album was released. Previously, they'd been the coolest band in the world, possibly, and appealed to an audience of guys mainly, but the True album was the band exploding into pop superstardom. At the end of the tour, May 1983, we had a number one single and album in the UK with True. It was number one for 4 weeks. It was an unavoidable huge hit. So Chrysalis in America, who previously had not really got to grips with the band, had to do something. But there were all sorts of promises that they were going to promote the band in America. So they said, we've appointed a new top 40 guy, who was Danny Glass, now hugely successful record company owner. So I showed him some photographs. He said, hey, great looking guys. So he said, well, play me the record. So I put the album on. And there's something fantastic, Tarquin, you'll know this, is when you've got a really good album and you know it's really good and you know it's got hits on it. And in fact, some of them, you've already had hits in a territory. There's a huge feeling of empowerment as you play it to people for the first time. So he's going, yeah, great. Hey, great, great, fantastic. Great, hey, great. That's great. Then True comes on. He goes, whoa. Hey, Steve, wait, whoa, this is a hit.
I don't think it did anything for the career of Spandau Ballet.
Gary Kemp of Spandau Ballet fame.
It did embed that song, though, in the American youth psyche. You know, what it represented as being the prom song. And yeah, I think a lot of people know that song more than they probably know the band. It, you know, it's good for the publishing. It's good for the music.
We did an arena tour of the US that was hugely successful. Again, we had screaming girls. Girls crying, but they're mollies. They're exactly that girl.
The film is named after a music track, 16 Candles, and he had a band I signed, the Stray Cats, re-record it. Here's Ron Payne.
In 16 Candles, he used the Stray Cats to cover
the song 16 Candles. That sort of set a trend, didn't it, for John, of using song titles for movies?
Yes. Yeah. You can copyright books and movies and whatever, but you can't copyright titles. So yeah, John used, what, 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink.
Some Kind of Wonderful.
Career Opportunities.
Ooh.
Was a Clash song.
Yeah.
Career Opportunities was a Clash song. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned, Tarquin, that the movie is named after a song title, and I feel like that is something people really associate with 80s movies now. Just off the top of my head, there are things like Dream a Little Dream, and of course, later from John Hughes, Pretty in Pink. What was the point of that? As a music supervisor in the 80s, why were so many movies named after classic song titles?
Because classic song titles sum up how we feel. I think with John, it also gave you a clue as to what he was listening to when he was writing the movie. But what John loved about music was that you could get a feel for a character's emotion into 2 minutes. He really admired that ability of song lyric writers, and coming from advertising, no surprise, where you have to condense what you're trying to get across into 30 seconds or 60 seconds. And so the format of a song really, really suited him. But Jimmy Iovine managed to get a soundtrack album out, and we're all really glad he did. Nick Hayward, one of John's favourites, he has two tracks on this soundtrack, plays under possibly one of the most embarrassing scenes ever, which is where the geek goes up to try and ask Molly Ringwald for a dance and a date, but two of her friends are sitting behind her, and they act as a sort of vicious Greek chorus. And it's toe-curlingly embarrassing. I've talked before about how John could spot emotional moments. And some emotional moments we know, you know, the getting married or having a baby. If you stand at an airport waiting for a friend and you see people coming out and hugging and kissing, you go, OK, that's an emotional moment. He spotted this, the asking for a date inappropriately in high school, and how that is just crushingly uncomfortable. And he got it just great, just great. I mean, John loved your music. How do we know? Because there's
amazing
two tracks in 16 Candles.
And yeah.
16 Candles is a movie where the last minute he went to Tower Records, just bought a load of the latest releases, went to the mixing stage and played records and made them run the film. I mean, this is not the way you do it, you know, not let's try this. Oh, I like it. Put that in. Well, have you got the rights? I don't care. That's how your music went.
Wow.
He loved it.
Wow.
So he put it in the scene where the geek talks to Sam and Sam says, go away. And then Whistle Down the Road is...
was in the bit, the dance scene, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. And that's yes. right. And while Sam is practicing pickup lines in the toilet.
Yes.
So, you know, well done. I mean, there's only a handful, five or six people who had a couple of tracks in John's film. So you're in illustrious company.
That is amazing. It's amazing. I can really appreciate it now.
Yeah.
You know, really, really appreciate it. I think just at 24-year-old Nick, I say that just, you know, on reflection, not as a narcissist. I'm saying 24-year-old Nick didn't really take compliments and things, opportunities too well, and didn't appreciate life so much. And that's the lovely thing that you get with age, is you appreciate everything, even the past.
Yeah. Did you notice any effect of the tracks being in 16 Candles? Did it affect, you know, ticket sales, album sales, the ability to tour, anything?
Well, the first time I actually noticed it was being in America, managed to actually sign to Universal. And so I got to be signed around the world. So that meant I went to America and I was in Los Angeles. I was staying at the Mondrian and I thought, this is great. I finally got here again. You know, there's been a budget and here I am. And I remember Sean Penn having breakfast and I thought, yeah, this is really cool. And then somebody came up and said, the guy from 16 Candles. So it was just suddenly like, that was what I was known for. And as an artist, that's definitely the way it like makes you feel. It's like, right, I've done my job.
This was the first film in which John examined dysfunctional parents, parents who had problems bigger than the teens themselves, and where the teens felt obliged to try and fix their parents. And that's something that is recurrent in John's films, all the way down to Ferris Bueller, where they become neutral. Then in Planes, Trains and Automobiles, they're idealised. And further into the 90s, in Home Alone, a film I produced with John, the parents are back to being neutral. They're not good or bad.
Yep.
But in this one, they have problems.
Yes. Although there is a redemption scene. I always find that's really the emotional peak of the movie, is when Sam and her father make up with each other, when her father apologizes to her for having forgotten her birthday. That's sort of the most emotionally true moment in the film, I think. Way more than her finally getting together with Jake, and certainly more than the nerd getting together with the prom queen. But, you know, like what you were saying earlier, Tarquin, about you can see that John Hughes realized that he was on the side of the nerds. It's interesting to see who the nerds are in this movie. So the nerd girl in this movie is played by Joan Cusack, and the nerd Ted, played by Anthony Michael Hall, his best friend, is played by John Cusack. So he obviously put in a lot of effort into casting the nerds, because John and Joan Cusack are, I think, two of the best actors of their generation. And they are both very, very funny in this film. And they get a lot more screen time than any of Jake's jock friends, who are really just forgettable and in the background.
That is a recurrent theme in John's films.
Right.
If you think back, you remember Cameron from Ferris.
Right.
You remember Mary Stuart Masterson from Some Kind of Wonderful. These wonderful characters that you just love. Whereas the hunk...
Exactly.
Meh.
And it's interesting that, as far as I know, Michael Schroeffling never worked with John Hughes again, whereas, of course, Anthony Michael Hall became his sort of male muse. And John Cusack, as you said in our second episode, did audition for The Breakfast Club, didn't get it, was very upset. And I think he then went on to star in Stand By Me, which was kind of his, or he's not starring in it, he plays the brother who dies at the beginning, but I think that helped to launch his career then.
Yeah, another great teen film, really. Because John had been casting The Breakfast Club before he cast this. That's how he knew Molly.
I see.
Etc. So he had these people in his mind from that when it came to 16 Candles.
Right. And going back to what you said before about 80s movies and different kinds of attitudes, the other 80s teen movie that John Cusack was in was The Sure Thing, directed by one of my other favorite directors, Rob Reiner. And the sure thing in it is sex. That's what the title refers to. And John Cusack plays a guy who drives across America because he reckons that there's this girl there who is the sure thing, that he will finally get to have sex. So that is like a constant theme in 80s teen movies. And it is... to John Hughes' enormous credit that in The Breakfast Club, he really ripped that up and showed how teens are anxious about sex, that they talk about it a lot, but they haven't done it, actually, and that there is this double bind for girls, like you mentioned. If they have sex, they're sluts. If they don't have sex, they're prudes. And then he just kind of lets it go in the rest of his teen films. Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller, Some Kind of Wonderful. Sex is not an issue. He sort of deals with it on an 80s teen level in 16 Candles. Then he blows it up in Breakfast Club, and then it's gone. And that really was John Hughes who rewrote that script.
I agree. And there's touching scenes too, like in Ferris, where Cameron admits that he was watching Mia undress, you know, but it's done nicely. It's not Porky's.
Right,
it's,
right.
You know, we've moved a long way from the shower scene in 16 Candles to that conversation.
Right.
And I think that's lovely. And he took teens seriously, not just using them as sort of pretty things to dance around and have sex with each other. He took them seriously. He took the fact that the best friend plays an incredibly important part in teen life. When we get older, we discard our best friends casually. When we move house, or when we get a new job, or when we make more money than them, or less money than them, friends come and go. Not when you're a teenager. When you're a teenager, you stick with that best friend.
And you know why that is, Tarquin.
Why is that?
It's because when you grow up, your heart dies. Ali Sheedy told us that already.
It's so true. It's so true. And you agonize as a teen in a way that one of the other characters says that feeling bad feels pretty good.
Exactly. Exactly.
Whereas when you're older, you just pour a glass of wine.
Now, on that note, I think we'll end this week, but we have more Molly Ringwald in the next episode in possibly her most iconic role, Pretty in Pink, one of my favorite John Hughes films.
With True. It's been licensed many, 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 many times for TV and for movies over the years, particularly in America. And very often the sinks are referential of that scene. It's the prom scene. It's the slow dance in the prom. But I think what John did when he put that in, it was very accurate because that was how the record was being consumed across the world. It was, you know, we now have this audience of teenage girls. You know, there were people slow dancing to it. He got it absolutely right. I cannot count how many times we've had syncs that actually reference that scene.
The box set, Life Moves Pretty Fast, the John Hughes mixtapes, is out now, released by Demon Music Group.
The Life Moves Pretty Fast podcast is a joint collaboration between Gimme Sugar Productions and Very Serious Comedy.